All right, the committee will come to order. We have minutes from the meeting yesterday. That was fast. Representative Mack, would you move the meetings, minutes?
I move the minutes, Mr. Chair.
All right, any discussion? Seeing none, all in favor say aye. Aye. All opposed? Motion prevails. Representative Clark. I will... where is it? Move House File 1680 be recommended pass and referred to the General Register. And we have a really, really packed schedule today.
We'll try to be brief, Mr.
Thank
Chairman.
You.
Basically, the bill that's before you is to have the legislature apologize on behalf of the citizens of the state to all the persons with mental illness and developmental disabilities and other disabilities that were wrongfully committed to the state institutions, sometimes removed from their families with no options given to the families, forced to work without pay, experiencing involuntary sterilization, lobotomies, various kinds of punitive treatments. And you can read more about it in the resolution. What basically we're saying is that the legislature would make an apology on behalf of those citizens. And I have two people who would like to testify briefly, Mr. Chairman.
That's wonderful. Welcome to the committee.
Mr. Chairman and the members of the committees, my name is Carol Robinson. I'm a member of Remembering Dignity. RWD has three parts. One of the projects is the restoration of state hospital cemeteries around the state. In your packet is a copy of the work we have been doing to bring dignity to many of our brothers and sisters who has passed away in institutions. Most of those people was buried and their marker carried only a number. We replaced their number with names. Number two, the second part of RWD is the apology. The apology is for the treatment that people received in state institutions for over 100 years. Some of the things that happened to people in institutions were roof showers. They had to clean the building stairs with a toothbrush. They couldn't even go outside on their own. They had to wait their turn. It could be a long time for a staff person to let them out of the place, not far, just outside. Number three, the third part of RWD is to let the world know that we are people with rights just like everyone else. We want to be accepted in society and act as citizens. It would be great if you could pass a few simple words. I am sorry for the treatment we received. It would mean a lot to us. Thank you.
Thank you. Welcome.
Okay. Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, I'm Rick Cardenas, and I'm with Advocating Change Together, and we're a disability rights, human rights, civil rights group for persons primarily with developmental disabilities, but other disabilities also. This apology has been brought forward to this committee way back in 1997, and it reached the floor. However, when it reached the floor, it was amended, and Betty McCollum, who was the author at that time, pulled it from the floor because it was being amended to say contrary to what the apology was. However, we're in a new time and a new legislature, and we think it may be time to bring forward this apology again. We've researched this over many years, and there are many states that have issued apologies, not specifically for the institutionalization of individuals, but for aspects of that, for instance, sterilization, for and the eugenics that states practiced. There is no, and there are no liabilities contained if this resolution is passed. Or at this point, we don't know of any state that has had to go to court over this apology at all. So, and besides that, many of the people are passing away so quickly. We closed our institutions in 1992. And in no way is this to blame the employees of those institutions at that time. However, it was a policy of the legislature, of the government, to allow those sort of treatments to happen. And again, we may have a new state-of-the-art and a new new ways that we treat people may have been changed. And so this is not to blame those employees from that time. But I say may have been changed because I think with some of the cuts that we're looking at in this legislative session and probably next legislative session, future legislatures will be apologizing for the treatment that people seem to be facing at this time. So when we look back, we hope that electroshock therapy will not happen, and appreciate it if you would bring this to the floor and debate this issue. So thank you very much.
Thank you. Any questions, members, or any discussion on the resolution? All right, seeing none, I'll renew my motion that House File 1680 be recommended to pass and re-referred to the General Register. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed? Motion prevails.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
So much for coming today.
Any members?
Thank you.
Thank you.
All right, Representative Tao will move adoption of the division report for 3212.
So moved, Mr. Chair.
All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed? Motion prevails. Representative Tao, will you move the bill as well, House File 3212?
I'll move that, Mr. Chair.
That it be recommended, passed, and re-referred to the General Register. And I have an oral amendment, which is to delete Section 1, okay, which Representative Simon has agreed to.
Yep.
Any discussion to that? Seeing none, all in favor of that motion say aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed? Okay. Any further discussion on the bill? Seeing none, all in favor of Representative Tall renew his motion that 3212 be recommended passed and referred to the General Register. All in favor of that motion say aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed? Motion prevails. Is Representative Kulik Jackson here? Okay. Let's move on. Representative Erdahl is here, I know. He just went to his office.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
If I could move the bill.
Sure.
Thank you.
All right. Representative A. Well, he's not here yet.
Oh.
Yeah.
I'll withdraw my motion.
All right. Is Representative Doty here? All right, he is. All right. I'll move that House File 2450 be recommended to pass and re-refer to the General Register. Representative Doty?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Relatively simple concept for this bill. As we face the dreadful decisions that we have to come to here for cutting, we're looking at ways to save money, especially out there in the healthcare field and especially out in rural Minnesota. There are several places we can do this, and one thing that we're looking at here in this bill is basically double licensing. And so what in very simple terms, what this bill would do, and there are four places where this takes place. If you have the research summary in front of you, it's probably the easiest to see. In sections 1 and 2, we're basically saying that if you are already licensed by a Class A home care provider, if you're Medicare licensed, that PCA individual does not need to be licensed by the state. And in sections 3 and 4, we are saying that same argument for the institutions. I have with me two individuals that you may remember from your committee tour a couple years ago from Horizon Health in Piers, Minnesota. And they will offer you some more details on this.
Thank you. Welcome to the committee.
Hello. My name is Pat Poster. I'm the Director of Home Care in Piers, Minnesota for Horizon Health. I'm here to support HF 2450 and to ask you to exempt Medicare Class A licensed agencies from the new regulations regarding PCA provider programs. I realize that there are providers out there that are not Class A licensed or Medicare certified that are providing PCA services, and I do understand that there is some regulation necessary for those providers. However, agencies that are already going through survey for both Medicare and Class A and are having positive surveys, in order for them to continue to do more regulation is just really cost prohibitive. We already provide annual training regarding safety, vulnerable adult, infection control, and the other trainings that are necessary to our staff. Some of the new requirements, such as having our staff, and for us it would be 10 staff, come down to St. Paul for a three-day training at the cost of $95 a person, plus hotel and mileage and staff time and meals, is just really a lot of money, besides the fact that we have clients that need to be seen during those days. And we don't have extra staff just sitting around waiting for hours. And so that means that we would have to send them in separate, probably in about two or three different separate sessions. If this requirement is due to the PCA summary paper of Joel Alter, which was from 11-16-09, which said that 23-28% of PCA samples were not providing the correct documentation, then, you know, I can understand. However, I would be curious to find out if those were Medicare-certified Class A licenses that were not following those regulations. This last year, we saw a significant decrease in our reimbursement, and we have received calls from many home care agencies, or actually from public health agencies in our surrounding counties, asking us to provide PCA services that are out of our service area because they don't have PCA agencies to provide those services in their counties. If we're looking at continuing PCA services, which I certainly hope that we are, then we need to really look at having those services be available to everybody in the rural areas, including our county and all the counties that are in the rural areas, because we just don't have the amount of PCA providers that might be down here in the metro area. So I'm really hoping that you can help us out. Cost of providing services is not going down. If you can keep the regulation down as much as possible, and allow us to provide the cares that we are there to provide, to take care of those people that need the services in their home, instead of spending time just doing documentation and other kind of regulation that is doubled up because of the different licensures that we hold, I'd really appreciate that. I would really like to invite all of you to come to our agency and see how we operate. I'd like you to look at our home care department and how we run it. Our financials are open to you. I'd like you to tour our assisted livings and certainly see what rural Minnesota assisted livings are like. There is a difference in what we provide and how we provide it. If we lose the PCA program, it will mean more and more people have to go to assisted living homes and nursing homes. That certainly can't be cost effective for the state. Thank you for your time.
Thank you. Any questions, members? Representative Gottwald.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, Representative Doty, only one question. I like the idea of removing, you know, undue regulations and duplication. It's certainly something we need to do more of in the healthcare area in general. One of my concerns is, how do we know that people coming from a non-Medicare Class A home to one that is qualified, so they're going to be exempt from these requirements, how do we know that that person is properly trained and has the proper skills and so forth? Is there a way to assure that? So you got somebody coming from outside to one of these facilities that's going to be exempted under the terms of this bill. How do you know that person's got the proper training?
If I'm understanding correctly, what you're saying is, if we hire somebody who has been working for a PCA provider who is not licensed, how do we know? We provide training to all of our new employees. the requirement under Class A and Medicare is that we provide that level of training to them. So we would provide them that training when they come to our agency.
Let's have the other testifier. Did you want to add something?
I just want to reiterate that Horizon Health and many Medicare-certified, Class A-certified home cares already work very hard to provide that level of training, and they are meeting those requirements, and it's shown in our annual surveys or our regular surveys. So I'm just really reiterating what Pat said, is we work hard to provide quality training so we can provide quality care. So.
Okay.
Thank you.
Representative Blaff.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Doty. Did this bill go to the licensing committee? We have a division that does that, and I'm a little uncomfortable taking the consumer protections away that we've put in statute that are supposed to be uniform across the state. And I'd feel more comfortable if those who actually look at the curriculum of these different licenses had actually compared the curriculum and to see if they are, it qualifies as long as you add on another 6 hours related to topic A that isn't in one training versus another. I just don't know enough about these.
We usually don't send these to licensing.
Okay, well, my question then is, has someone gone through the curriculum of these different licensing programs and actually made sure that they are truly duplicative, or is there segments in one training that needs to be added on to a Class A home care license, for example? I mean, I'm thinking of, you know, if you're taking care of someone who's ventilator dependent, that's really high-end specialty care. And I don't know if that training is a typical part of home care license A. For those of us who don't know the licensing requirements of curriculum, I'm just wondering if someone has actually gone through these training to make sure there's not things that are would be left out.
To the witnesses.
Mr. Chair, what I can say to that is we know what the regulations are to remain Medicare certified and Class A licensure. Pat reviews those and knows those forwards and backwards, and we train all of our staff to the level of the Class A licensure. And when we looked at what this bill was bringing to us as for requirements, we saw a lot of duplication. And so that's what we can see from our side. And when we have those special cases, we have 8 RNs on staff, and we train any aide who's going into a home to meet the needs, to be able to meet the needs of that. So there's a lot of one-on-one training that happens. Pat, did you have anything else to add to that?
No, I can't speak directly to the ventilator question because our agency does not provide that service. Those agencies that do provide that, I'm sure that they have their own rules that they need to follow for that.
Yeah. So the question really is, if you get a Class A or a Medicare certified, is there anything that isn't in that license that you'd have to do to meet that license that would be covered in the license you're trying to get out of?
In the PCA bill, they're proposing.
In the PCA bill. You know, I really have not, I don't know exactly what the curriculum is. I understand it has to do with PCA billing. And I could understand if possibly you had to come to some of the training if it was duplicate, you know, if it wasn't duplicative. But I don't believe that DHS has looked at that either.
Okay.
To make sure that it isn't duplicative.
Is DHS here? Can you come down and let us know? Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. My name is Pam Urkel. I am with the Department of Human Services. And the answer to the question is that we worked with the Department of Health as well as stakeholders, and we looked at the OLA reports as well as working with a home care advisory committee. And many of these requirements that we're asking for the agencies to comply with were recommended by that. I mean, in terms of the actual training for PCAs, There are very specific things in there that we are asking for PCAs to know that home health aides don't necessarily know. I'm also wondering if we're talking about strictly just Medicare certified Class A agencies or PCA agencies that are only Class A certified. When speaking with the Department of Health, and I don't know if they're here, but there was some discussion about the fact that what we were putting into statute last year and what passed last year were stronger standards than that what they currently had in their Class A licensure. So,
the way that I read the bill, it's either Class A or Medicare certified.
So, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, that was the discussion that we had with the Department of Health, is that they felt that the standards that we were putting in for PCA services were stronger than what they had in the Class A license.
So is this a Department of Health question as opposed to a Department of Human Services question? Do you guys have a does the department have a position on this bill?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, we couldn't support the bill the way it was written because of the fact that we really strongly believe that even Class A license agencies need to go through the training that we provided. Now, I think we need to understand as well that there are several different trainings that were passed last year. One for the qualified professionals, one for the actual PCA workers themselves, and then one for the actual PCA provider organizations. And so there are differences in each one of those trainings. So when we develop the PCA worker training, which is currently in pilot status, it is an online training which PCAs don't have to actually come to St. Paul for. They can take the training online. There's going to be a certification for them coming from that online training that they will be able to take to the provider organization and say that they've taken the training and that they've passed the competency testing.
Let's see if we can do this. Can we? This is what I'm going to suggest: is that we lay this on the table temporarily. That you, if you can, kind of go out. Maybe if the Department of Health is here, go out in the hallway and figure out what we can and cannot do, and then come back to us. Does that work? Okay, let's try that. So we'll lay this temporarily over. Representative Kulik Jackson, welcome to the committee. I'll move House File 3634 be recommended to pass and re-refer to the Committee on Public Safety Policy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and good afternoon to the committee. I have with me David Coons, Government Relations for the Minnesota Chiropractic Association, and the bill is short, and would prohibit the granting of a license to practice chiropractic to any person who's been convicted of a felony-level criminal sexual conduct offense. You may have in your packet a copy of a Star Tribune article that made me say yikes. And I'd be happy to stand for questions, and if you would like Mr. Coons to testify, certainly can, or simply respond to any questions.
Are you all right with this, Mr. Coons? Just say yes.
Yes, we are.
Thank you. Representative Abler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and we actually heard this very same or similar bill in the licensing subcommittee, and it was quite popular there. Popular in terms of that none of us were going to stand for this kind of behavior, and the question came up in the subcommittee, like, who else has this? And only the Board of Medical Practice was so able. And I was surprised, I didn't know about this until I read the paper, and I was surprised that my board did not have the authority to jerk the ticket of this licensee, except they had to load on some things which were meant to be, you know, burdensome, but they only had so many limits. And so per the question that came up in the subcommittee, I asked staff if they had prepared an amendment to extend this to all the licensees under Chapter 214. If I could offer an oral amendment, I'd like to do that so that it can be uniformly across the board, and that way no board will find itself in the position of having to have their hands tied like this. And if that's in order, I'll have Ms. Aves read the oral amendment.
Ms. Aves, sure.
Mr. Chair and members,
The amendment would be on 1.8, delete the and insert A. 1.9, delete practice of chiropractic 2 and insert after person licensed pursuant to the provisions of 214.01 subdivision 2. So that sentence would read, a board may not grant a license to any person licensed pursuant to the provisions of 214.01 subdivision 2. That section of statute lists all of the health-related licensing boards.
Mr. Chair, I imagine then 1.11 would also need a reference change.
Yes, that would be correct. We would need to delete the word chiropractic. We'd need to delete of chiropractic.
And Mr. Chair, I'll move that amendment then.
So any discussion? You know, my only concern is that we didn't have hearings from the other boards and practitioners other than chiropractic. I'm not imagining that they would probably oppose this, so I guess I'll leave it up to the discretion of the body here. And it's going to go to public safety. Okay. All right. Well, then, see no discussion on that amendment. Well, first of all, is there anybody in the audience who wants to testify about it? Okay, seeing none. All in favor of the amendment, say aye.
Aye.
All opposed? Motion prevails. Any further discussion on the bill? Seeing none. All in favor, I will renew my motion that House File 3634 be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Committee on Public Safety. All in as amended. All in favor of that motion, say aye.
Aye.
All opposed? Motion prevails. Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay. So we're going to get our next person who's going to come. So members, if we don't get done in time, we're going to move immediately after this committee time to 500 South or North? 500 South to finish up everything. And the request is that don't take your folders with you. Just put stuff in it, and staff will take stuff up to 500 South because we don't want to lose things. So that's been the request. All right. Well, let's, Representative Abler, why don't you move House File 3347 be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Committee on Finance.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd like to move that, and it's a good bill.
And there's a DE1 amendment as well.
I'd like to move the DE1. And I just to explain the bill, which is from my seatmate. I believe it's one licensing for all the school stuff, and it's good for America.
Right. So I think if you have multiple concession stands at a high school football field, you can just get one license. Is the gist of it?
Why?
Department of Health. Do you want to, anybody want to test? Oh, is there? Can the department come down and just let us know if there's a cost to this? Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representatives, I'm Colleen Paulus with the Minnesota Department of Health, manager of the Food, Beverage, and Lodging Program. In regards to this bill, we would use existing fee resources to pay for the service. In terms of the estimate, in terms of how much it would be to the department, our database does not have an exact field for school concession stands at this point, so we basically did a guesstimate in terms of how many schools. We estimated about 236 high schools or middle schools would have at least one concession stand. So we guessed it would be maybe around $35,000, and we would just use our existing fee resources to cover the services to the schools.
Okay. And is there any cost to the schools? It would be down. It would be reduced cost to the schools, right?
Mr. Chair, representatives, yes, it would be a reduced cost to the schools.
Okay. So, Representative Liebling.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Abler, you know, maybe you could just, you know, just to give me a little comfort here, could you just say a little bit more about this bill before we pass it out here? Like, you know, what is the problem that brought this here and, you know, what you're trying to do, and just a little bit so that we can know what we're doing here?
Representative Abler.
Well, thank you. I actually had a similar bill about multiple concession stands at the Halloween parade in Anoka that was owned by one area. It's a one-day thing, and they made them get six licenses for six. Here comes the author. But they made them get multiple licenses for kind of the same group, and it's pocket change to us, but it was a very big deal to these small groups. But I'd like to yield to Representative Erdahl to continue explaining the bill.
So the question is, what problem is this trying to solve?
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members. Last session, we changed how fees are charged for school concession stands, and it's meant that for various facilities, stands in the school, they're charged a separate fee. For example, Eden Valley Watkins has a football field with two concession stands on it, and they were charged separately for each one. And what this does, the 3347, would charge a flat rate per school. So one school pays, if they've got two concession stands, they're just paying for one. And basically, that's it. It would be under the supervision of the school lunch personnel, basically the lunch ladies. And I've talked to the Department of Health. They are on board with this. The cost would be about $35,000, and the department has told me they could absorb that.
And they just said that as well.
Yeah, Mr. Chair.
Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, Representative Erdahl, it doesn't sound like this really has any health implication at all, does it?
Well,
Representative Erdahl.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. No, the health implication is that these are inspected by the health department. That's pretty much it.
Right, Mr. Chair.
Representative.
So, Representative Erdahl, and so under this bill, the inspection continues the same way. There's no change in that. It's just essentially a bureaucratic change.
Yes.
Representative. All right. Okay. So, you know, further questions or discussion? Representative Abler renews his. First of all, we need to vote on the DE1 amendment. All in favor of that amendment, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed? Motion prevails. Representative Abler renews his motion that House File 3347 be recommended pass. We are going to, as amended, we are going to send it to finance because I think Representative Ryland wants to see if she can actually get some savings out of it. So we're going to continue on to finance. All in favor of that motion, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed? Motion prevails. Thank you, Representative Erdahl.
Thank you very much.
Representative Hosh. Which one do you want to go with?
Mr. Chair, that is a good question and one that you can... No, why don't we do 3264, Mr. Chair? I got Ann Henry's with me, too, who can help us with the watch.
All right. I will move House File 3264 be recommended to pass and re-refer to the Committee on Finance. And you also... Is this A1 amendment one you want to put on right away?
Please, Mr. Chair.
All right. I'll also move the A1 amendment to get the bill in the... order that the author would like it. All in favor of that motion, say aye.
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 All opposed? Motion prevails. Representative Hosh.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. House File 3264 is a follow-up to the PCA reforms that happened last legislative session. When you make significant changes to a program, oftentimes there's unintended consequences or clarifications that need to be made, and this bill hopefully will do that. The bill has been drafted to be hopefully budget neutral, even though we're going on to finance. I do believe it's budget neutral. I'll try to do a brief walkthrough section by section. And with the amendment, the first section has been deleted. The first pertinent section, what it does is addresses a recipient who is receiving PCA services, and also includes that instrumental activities of daily living includes that a person can get to medical appointments as long as that's within their written plan for PCA services. Another section.
Sorry. Okay.
And the numbering gets confusing because we deleted the first section, Mr. Chair, but so please bear with me on that. Section 2, which is the old Section 3.
Why don't we just refer to them by their
original section numbers?
Sure, I think that's easy.
Okay. Section 3, Section 3 adds a definition for extended personal care services under the waivers, which is pretty consistent with what we all already do, and also gives a definition for wages and benefits. Last year, we required that PCAs receive at least 72.5% of their reimbursement to go to wages and benefits. We clarified what wages and benefits meant, in particular with reimbursement for travel and other contributions made within that employee benefit plan. Also, we did a clarification for instrumental activities of daily living for children. Right now, PCAs generally don't do home care, don't do cleaning and those type of activities. But we did clarify that when that is needed for the health of a child, those personal hygiene services and home services, if it's in the plan by the assessor, are an appropriate activity for that personal care assistant. The next section, Section 5, one of the things we had originally that for certain different activities of daily living that they had to be on a daily basis, we deleted that and put ongoing because there's conditions where you might not want a service provided on a daily basis. For instance, if it's an elderly person and bathing activities, they may not have to be or want to be bathed every single day because of different skin irritations or medical occurrences that you would like to avoid daily bathing. So that's just one example why we had to make that change. Okay. Yep. Too many bills today, Mr. Chair. So,
we could cut them down.
Going on to old Section 6. This deals with some training. We made some clarifications that training for the PCA services has to be in other languages and also accommodations for people with disabilities. We need to recognize that individuals with disabilities also have the ability and the right to provide services and to be active in the workforce, and that includes PCAs. And we ought to make every accommodation we can for them to be able to participate in that and the training that we require upon them. The next portion of this section with the number of hours worked per day by the personal care assistance agency cannot be disallowed by the department. There is disagreement in this section right now. Currently, the department generally can do an edit or a review of hours if it exceeds 16 hours in a day. This would prevent the department from doing that. At this point, I would like to have further discussions with the department and advocates because I understand why the department would want to do some edits at times if somebody is exceeding a certain number of hours per day. But there are also circumstances, emergency circumstances, where an agency shouldn't be given undue bureaucratic requirements when it comes to the hours.
What does an edit mean? What does that mean?
Mr. Chair, from my understanding, and I can be corrected if I'm wrong, is that if somebody exceeds working a certain number of hours in a day, it kind of puts a flag into the system. And the department will review that and ask the agency, why is this occurring? Most of the time, it's for very good reasons. You might have a PCA that may work multiple days in a row, or because of an emergency situation, another PCA may be sick. All kinds of different reasons. It can be burdensome for some providers, but like I said, I understand why you have a system that creates that flag, and I would like to continue moving forward to try to find some compromise in that area.
Is that that you want?
And another concern, too, and Mr. Chair, I'm sorry. These agencies, their claims are immediately denied when an edit is done, even if it may be for legitimate reasons, and they're not reimbursed until at a later date, and that's problematic. So I would envision a compromise being that when an edit is done, you could have you would have a reimbursement, but also a review process. And if that review process showed that there was an error or any wrongdoing, then it would have to be reimbursed. But we'll work that out as
That's
we
good. It seems like we flagging them isn't that big of a deal. So, all right.
Okay, the next session deals with training. Right now, we require training of agencies, of qualified professionals, and of personal care assistants. One of the things that we say is that in here is that we exempt Medicare certified agencies. They already have to meet a very high threshold of training, and it seems duplicative and overly burdensome. We've been working with the home care agencies on this, and it seems that it is generally accepted. It also says that we have to require this training online through electronic means. This is fits for rural Minnesota because oftentimes, why do you have to come down for a training if you can test out or take that training through electronic means? And also a qualified professional. Qualified professional members is essentially kind of a supervisor of personal care assistants. That qualified professional is allowed to be employed before they take that training because the training right now is not necessarily offered online at this point.
Have you talked to Representative Doty? How does this intersect with the bill we heard before?
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, this includes Representative Doty's concerns in it, both for the agency and the qualified professional exemptions for Medicare agencies. So this is essentially a duplication of what Representative Doty's bill does on its own.
Does this include Class A licenses standing alone or just Medicare certified?
Just Medicare certified.
Okay. All right.
Okay. Also within this section, it allows qualified professionals to do their supervision of a personal care assistant, with a phone visit after 180 days or 6 months. Section 9 is to do some clarification. Right now, a PCA choice agency essentially is kind of the pass-through agency between the recipient who has the hiring and firing ability of a personal care assistant. The PCA choice agency kind of does all the payroll, the paperwork requirements, and all those areas. Oftentimes, there is agreements that are signed between the recipient and the personal care agency. This is saying that according to the terms of the agreement, they have to be given, and this is saying that it just has to comply by this written agreement between the choice agency and the recipient. So it's clarification, and the next section follows through with that. By saying that the terms of the written agreement has to, that's the next section, I'm sorry. Section 10 removes qualified professionals from the ability to be hired or fired by the recipient. Again, the qualified professional is essentially the supervisor of the personal care assistant, and the recipient has the power to hire and fire the PCA, but not the qualified professional. The next section is that this annual agreement between the agency and the recipient must be provided to the responsible party, the PCAs, and the recipient once it's been completed. Okay. Next section, the largest change is the non-compete clause. Right now, some agencies were saying if you left the agency that you could not go and work for another agency in the future. We ban that practice. It's especially prohibitive in rural Minnesota. The next point is on a clarification for the training requirements.
Can we just go back to that one? So So this is banning a certain kind of contractual provision.
Mr. Chair, this is saying that agencies cannot require a personal care assistant to sign a non-compete clause for their employment.
Mm-hmm. All right, we'll keep going.
The next section clarifies who is responsible to take the training within the agency component of our training requirements. We clarified that it has to be those who are involved in the day-to-day management of the company and not simply all owners and supervisors and management. This came about when there was a brief interpretation that board of directors would have to take the training. And for most of these agencies, they're a volunteer board of directors. They're there to offer their expertise and their background to the operation of the business or of the agency, but they are not involved in the day-to-day operations. We wanted to make that perfectly clear that it wasn't required to be of all board of directors. This also has an exemption for the agencies that if they are Medicare certified, that they don't have to take the agency training requirements. The last section, I believe, yes. The last section allows that if there is a reduction of hours in the contract due to a reassessment, that if an individual appeals that determination, that they are allowed to keep their current hours until that appeal is completed. And this is a very big issue because we need to allow the time of the individual to prepare for a reduction in hours and also their right to appeal that determination in case the assessor missed anything. And that is pretty much the entire bill.
Any discussion, members?
Mr. Chair?
I think that's right.
Mr. Chair, I think that is, I have been informed, members, that with the non-compete clause, that might require this to go to civil justice. We have another opportunity to deal with this. So I would like to, at this point, if anybody would be so kind to possibly remove
I'll move to delete section 12.
Okay.
All right, all in favor of that motion, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed? Motion prevails. So we can do that on your bill next week. Larry?
Mr. Chair? I believe it's not the entire section that you want to delete.
Oh, you're right. Okay. So let's reconsider that motion. All in favor of that, say aye.
Aye.
All opposed? Motion prevails. And I'll move to delete lines 1532 to 1534. All right. All in favor of that motion, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed? Motion prevails. Thank you. Okay. Any questions on the bill, members? Representative Loeffler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'm on page 3, lines 3.6 to 3.9, and there's some references elsewhere, but this one seems to be the bigger opening. It seems to allow people to exceed the 310-hour monthly work limit because of a need for intermittent care up to an amount designated in the individual service plan as long as there's a backup. And to me, this really is a big loophole that kind of negates that 310 hours if the service plan gets to trump that limit, not just on an emergency basis because a PCA is sick and so someone has to do an extra shift or something like that. I'm not comfortable, quite honestly, with the 310-hour a month work limit. That's 10 hours a day or more every day of the month. And we all know, because we've been working 14-hour days, that we're not at our best at the end of those days. And particularly for vulnerable populations that require this kind of service, it really does feel to me like it's actually better to have more people in your life than less, especially if they're burnt out and they never get a break. And so I'm a little uncomfortable with this, but maybe you can explain again why the individual service plan would guide us being able to exceed 310 hours except in an emergency.
Mr. Chair, this was removed with the amendment. It's no longer in the bill.
We went back to, so thank you. No sleep. I can't keep up.
All right.
Which, Mr. Chair, Representative Loeffler made your point.
Representative Gottwald.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Hosh, appreciate the bill. I do have a little concern. You referenced it early when you started your presentation about the cost involved, and I realize this isn't a finance committee, but it's on lines 4.11 through 4.15 on wages and benefits. That's, I think, where my concern would be that we're adding cost here, and maybe you have the same concern, but.
Representative Hosh.
Mr. Chair, Representative Gottwald, this will not affect the cost. The agency receives the same reimbursement. This is essentially defining what is included under the wage and benefits determination for that encumbrance that we did last year. We required a 72.5% encumbrance of the reimbursement to going to wages and benefits.
So this is all included.
This clarifies what wages and benefits is.
Any further discussion on the bill? Seeing no further discussion, I will renew my motion that House File 3264 be recommended to pass as amended and be re-referred to the Committee on Finance. All in favor of that motion say aye.
Aye.
All opposed? Motion prevails. 3252, Representative Hosh. Yeah, can that work? Okay. I move House File 3252 be recommended to pass and re-refer to the Committee on Finance and the A1 as well. I'll move the A1 amendment to get the bill in the order the author would like it. All in favor of that motion say aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed? Motion prevails. Representative Hosh.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is a bill that I'm absolutely proud to author and was one of the first bills I authored under my first term. This deals with MAEPD, and I'm not going to give a large explanation, but essentially what medical assistance employed persons with disabilities does is allow for an asset exclusion. So we don't use as strict of an asset guideline for determining eligibility for MA. For individuals with disabilities, MA is a vital component to their care and daily living. And we want to also recognize and encourage that individuals work. And currently right now, because MA is such an essential component for many individuals, is they simply will not work so they can remain eligible for medical assistance. That is not a message that we want to send anyone. And MAEPD helps address that issue by saying, if you continue to work and you have a disability, you can have an increased asset limit and still maintain your benefits. One of the problems that we have is once you hit 65, MAEPD cuts off, and that asset limit for somebody who may have worked for the last 10 years, 15 years, built up some assets, they hit 65, still need medical assistance for their care and daily needs, no longer can work, even if they love their job, want to continue working. In my opinion, see some very tragic situations having to result in tragic decisions. Families divorcing after a long marriage simply because the assets will kick somebody off of medical assistance. This allows for the exclusion of assets for the individual and for their spouse after they turn 65. They have to be on MAEPD for the 24 months prior. This makes sense. I'm not sure if we can fiscally do this year, but we need to keep a spotlight on this unfortunate situation that essentially discriminates based on age.
Welcome to the committee.
Am I supposed to talk?
Yep.
Okay. Well, my name is Drayton Orberg. I am 67 years old. I used to work for TCF, Twin City Federal Savings and Loan, as a mortgage loan collector. Since I worked downtown Minneapolis, I took the bus instead of driving a car. But one morning, while I was walking to the bus stop, a woman saw a mud puddle in the middle of the street, swerved in the curb, and struck me, and I ended up with multiple injuries, including brain injury. The most important of that brain injury is short-term memory. Now, I now work at Kowalski's only 3 days a week, 4 hours a day, bringing baskets, carts back. I like my job, and I like to save money. Of course, saving money was important to me because I used to work for a savings and loan. And when I was 65, I got off of the MAB. I got MA only because of my birthday. No, I had a lot. And I think I had to pay like $14,000. Mm-hmm. Because I wasn't on MA anymore. And I had $25,000 in medical bills. I paid about $14,000 so far, but $11,000 left. And I think it's so unfair, just because I turned 65, that I can't be on medical assistance anymore.
Thank you. Any Representative Cobble?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Hosh, you understand this a lot better than I do, so I'm just looking for some education here. So somebody is on MAEPD, they reach 65, they're automatically disenrolled if they have a certain amount of assets, correct?
Yeah.
Mr. Chair, Representative Gottwald, correct.
Of course, I was unaware of this, and then the county says, well, you should have called and asked. I wouldn't even know you needed to call and ask, you know?
Fair point.
Mr. Chair, that's helpful. So what you're trying to do here is allow them to keep some assets and continue automatically on MA, or they have to apply for the MA, but the assets don't apply?
Representative Hosh.
Mr. Chair, Representative Gottwald, they would be able to continue as they are on MAEPD with the current asset limit, which I believe is
$20,000.
Also, there's a notification clause in here.
Yeah,
somewhere too.
At the end of the bill. Yep, I saw that.
Representative Gottwald.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hosh, so they're they just automatically continue, or do they have to do anything at 65, or do they just...
You take me off at 65, too old, you know? To me, like it's age discrimination, you know?
Mr. Chair, Representative Gottwald, if they continue working and under the circumstances as they were at 64 years, 364 days old, they just continue to live life and work and maintain their status as a covered MA recipient who's working.
Well, one thing about it's working. I don't make a lot of money working. It's only 3 days a week, 4 hours a day. But I enjoy doing this. It keeps me busy. It's something I like doing, you know? A lot more menial I used to do before I got stuck by that car.
Any further discussion on the bill? Does everybody understand?
That's okay. Going to finance, right?
It's going to finance, yeah. So I'll renew my motion that House File 3252, as amended, be recommended to pass and re-refer to the Committee on Finance. All in favor of that motion say aye.
Aye.
All opposed? Motion prevails.
Good job.
Do we know how we're doing on Representative Doty's bill?
Thank you.
So let's let's see. So I'll move that House File 3442 be re-referred to the Committee on Finance without recommendation. And Representative Tao, do you have an oral amendment on this one?
Mr. Chair, I do, but maybe I'll do the oral amendment and then the testifier could talk a little bit on it too.
Well, we can wait till that testifier.
Why don't we have the testifier talk and then oral amendment come right after that or something? Okay.
Okay. Representative Hosh.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. House File 3442, in all honesty, it pains me to have this bill before us and to be an author of this bill. As we know, and I think everybody in this room knows through personal experiences, that
The decisions with our budget cuts have real life impacts. And the budget that we have before us this year is no brighter than what we've had to deal with in the past years. I can do math, and when we look at the budget targets that have gone before us and the other committees and finance divisions have moved, a total of about $313 million in reductions. When you take the federal dollars that's assumed, the current reductions that's done, and also the insistence of this legislature to keep education harmless, I can do the math and realize that the potential budget targets in Health and Human Services are quite bleak at over $300 million. To put that in perspective, the governor's budget, his own budget, has less than $200 million of general fund cuts. And that is scary for me. And I thought it was important that we put into perspective what some of the decisions may be ahead of us. Those decisions can be difficult, but they need to be discussed because I believe that we need to look at our decisions and try to look at it with a different light than just simply across-the-board cuts. We see that with our long-term care, a simple across-the-board cut. We need to have a little more innovation in our approach, and I hope this bill spurs that discussion, allows us to work with the department with some different ideas and to look at data a little differently to see how we can spread some potential pain to those who are most able to address it and not those who are most vulnerable. But this bill is painful all the way around. The first section increases license fees mainly for assisted living facilities and also requires nursing assistants to pay a $50 registration fee. The next section just essentially says that the fees and the registration charges are put into the general fund. The next section adds to the registration requirement when it comes to assisted living. That services in the base rate, the basic services in the base rate are provided to the individual. Section 5 is going to be deleted by Representative Howell's oral amendment later that deals with transitional counseling for individuals moving into assisted living or nursing facility level of care. And that's quite controversial, and the House didn't have a position on it last year. The Senate did. And I respect the House's position, and that's a fight for a different date. The next component on page 4 requires that a portion of the base rate that constitutes rent and also charges for services beyond the base rate be provided to the individual. It's kind of a transparency clause. Section 7 deals with Uniform Consumer Information Guide, nothing too substantial. Section 8 requires that if a lease is terminated, that the individual be provided information about the ombudsman and their rights as an individual. Section 9. Section 9 again is a information transparency clause. Within that guide, that also services covered by Medicare are addressed. I do believe I'm done. On page 6, Mr. Chair, is a requirement for the senior linkage line, I believe. To provide information, we're not at the senior linkage line yet. To add for services that the senior linkage line is required to provide individuals, and that includes price comparisons, including charges for rent and services available to the individual. Hopefully, again, more transparency within the charges and customized living arrangements. Section 11 is one of the most painful parts of this bill, and what it does, it accelerates the requirement for two activities of daily living in order to be eligible for PCA services. I thought it was important to put that in there because that is going to be a reality come July 1st of 2011. And many of you may have received emails recently about this, and those emails express a very real and justified concern about this bill. Section 12 is a $50 fee for personal care assistance. Section 13 is going to be deleted in the oral amendment that deals with transitional counseling again. Section 14 talks about rate reductions for customized living, essentially assisted living facilities. This is one of the areas where I think we need to kind of look outside of the box. Minnesota has a very high concentration of assisted living facilities. There can be a debate that that high concentration is a good thing as it prepares us for a tsunami of aging individuals. Others may say that our services may be too generous and require an environment of profitability at a time when we're doing a lot of budget cuts. Right now, Minnesota, with a recent report, shows that Minnesota has double the concentration of assisted living facilities to the next closest state in our union. So we have a high concentration of assisted living facilities. And the rate reductions that we propose be tiered based on the density of assisted living facilities by county. Essentially saying that counties that have a low density receive a less of a cut, and those counties that have higher density of assisted living would receive more of a cut, with the assumption that they may be able to absorb those cuts more easily. I'm not sure if that assumption is accurate, but that is one of the reasons why we're here today, so we can move it on to Finance Committee and continue to look at these ideas and the assumptions made. Section 15 and 16 will be deleted in an oral amendment. This was another area in which we had an assumption in which Medicare would have a correlation with increased per diem rates for facilities. The department has run the numbers and have dealt with this, and it showed that there's absolutely no correlation whatsoever. The numbers are don't follow any logical sequence. Because of that information now that we have, we'll just delete those sections because it doesn't pay for us to pursue that idea.
Should we just delete them right now?
Sure, Mr. Chair.
I mean, this is separate, not the things you want to testify about. Right, okay. Representative Tao moves that House Sections 6, 15, and 16 be deleted. All in favor of that motion say aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed?
Mr. Chair, Section 17 is probably the only, or one of the only bright spots of this bill. What it does is remove the delay of rebasing and accelerates that up so we can do rebasing of nursing facilities and try to bring some more equity in our reimbursement rates throughout the state. Section 8.
That's going to cost money?
Mr. Chair, that would cost some money, yes. And part of this bill is to propose, you know, paying for it with other reductions. Section 18, Mr. Chair, is a nursing facility rate reduction. Again, this is an idea. Again, I'm not sure if it's going to make sense, but we ought to pursue every idea that we have within these economic and fiscal situation that we're in. What it does is provide a tiered rate reduction. So for facilities that have a higher private payer mix, they would receive a higher cut of up to 3%. For facilities that have a lower private payer mix and rely more heavily on MA reimbursements, they would receive a lower rate reduction. This ties in with Section 19, which uses the governor's proposal to eliminate eventually eliminate equalization within our nursing facilities. So with these two sections combined, essentially what could happen is the nursing facility that has a higher private payer mix receives a larger reduction, and they're able to absorb that reduction more because they have that private pay ability to have a greater differential between private pay and MA individuals.
Okay, we're going to lay this bill over momentarily and probably pick it up when we go upstairs. And I think Representative Doty, why don't you come back down? We'll get House File 2450 before us again. So I will move that be recommended to pass and re-refer to the General Register. Representative Doty, I understand that you've had some discussions and worked something out.
Mr. Chair, we've had very good discussions, actually, and we have worked something out, and I appreciate greatly the committee's latitude on allowing us time to do this. What we have reached agreement on here
and
is...
So this is going to be my motion, members, to amend the bill, I think. So, Representative Doty.
What we have reached agreement on is in, let's see, we are on page 2 of the bill, strike all of the new language.
So we can just delete section 1.
You can delete the new language in section 1.
Okay. All right.
On page 3 in section 2, on line 3.29, after the word currently, strike the rest of that line, and on 3.30, strike the first 5 words through the word or. So the beginning of that would read, a qualified professional employed by a personal care assistance provider agency currently certified for participation in Medicare. So we have eliminated the Part A part. And we're doing the same thing 2 more times. This Part 3, Section 3, is on 5.21. Again, after the word currently, strike the rest of that line. And on 5.22, strike the word or. And on page 6, the last page of the bill, on 6.3, after the word currently, strike the rest of that line, and on 6.4, strike everything up to the word certified. So we have the same correction in all 3 places.
Okay. Does everybody understand that amendment? Okay. All in favor of the amendment say aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed? Motion prevails. Any further discussion on the bill, members? Does this help you somewhat?
Yes.
Okay.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, it does. Good. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Well, that, okay. You're welcome. So I'll renew my motion that House File 2450 as amended be recommended pass and referred to the General Register. All in favor of that motion say aye.
Aye.
All opposed? Motion prevails. All right. So what we're going to thank you very much for coming today. Nice. What we're going to do now is we're going to move up to 500 South. So we'll recess until 4:30, and then we'll start the testimony on our last Representative Hosh's bill. That's the only bill that's left. Yes. All right. So we're in recess. So I think we're through the bill, actually. So I guess we'll start with testimony. Ms. Thurlow and Mr. Pearson, are you going to come up together? Okay. Welcome to the committee.
For the record, my name is Carrie Thurlow. I'm with Aging Services of Minnesota and appearing here on behalf of the Long-Term Care Imperative. Our presentation is going to be split into 3 parts, being cognizant of the time, of course. So I will be joined by Christine Bakke, who is the Care Center Administrator with St. Benedict Senior Community in St. Cloud, Minnesota, and Toby Pearson, who is with Care Providers of Minnesota. All 3 of us are here on behalf of the Long-Term Care Imperative. The Long-Term Care Imperative is opposed to nearly every provision in House File 3442. I think that's the first time I've ever said that about the While there are 1 or 2 items that we support, and we'll certainly get into details on that, on balance, we can only characterize House File 3442 as one of the most onerous bills with respect to older adult services that we've seen in years. This bill will negatively impact every portion of the spectrum of older adult services, leaving Minnesota in a worse position to provide care and services to our seniors. Because our time to testify on this bill is limited, we're unable to cover our objections, all of our objections to the bill, and what you'll find in your packet is a memo from Mr. Pearson and I summarizing the provisions and our more detailed comments. We're happy to discuss each of those items if there are any questions, but we'll limit our testimony today to three major issues. First is the mandatory transitional consultation. Second is rate equalization, and third are the rate cuts. So maybe the first issue we'll talk about is the mandatory transitional consultation, and I believe Representative Tao and Representative Thiessen have said that there is an amendment on this, but so I'll just provide some brief testimony. There is a handout in your packet on this explaining our objections to this provision that are contained in sections 5 and 13 of the bill. Briefly, House File 3442 contains proposals in sections 5 and 13 that would require mandatory transitional consultation, or basically would require seniors to get a certificate from the government before they, no matter whether the senior has will be paying for assisted living services through private funds or through elderly waiver, they would need a certificate from the governor, or from the government, excuse me, before they could enter into a contract for housing with services options. We believe that, quite frankly, this is a thinly veiled attempt to divert seniors from assisted living and infringes on the fundamental right of seniors to make choices in where they reside and where they receive supportive services. It is a proposal that we oppose strongly. While we do value getting consumers the information they need in a timely fashion, we believe that there's a better way to do that. We've been working cooperatively with stakeholders at DHS as well as with consumer groups to figure out how to do this, and we think that perhaps this goes too far. It's also important to note that we've discussed this provision with AARP of Minnesota, and they would support our urging of this committee to remove those provisions from the bill. I'd be happy to answer questions about that, but about that particular provision.
So does anybody want to testify in favor of the provision? And that, that's seriously. So, I mean, because one of the issues, I think, and it's not, this may not be the best way to get at it, but is, you know, this is the concentration of assisted living in Minnesota relative to other states. And maybe you could talk briefly about what the dynamic is that leads to that. So we just have some information in front of us that Minnesota has a penetration of 104 assisted living facility rooms per 1,000 elderly, which is probably three times as high as the next closest state.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I don't have that information in front of me, but if that's the Harvard study that you're referring to,
It's in Health Affairs.
Okay. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm aware that there have been conversations about the density of assisted living, and certainly we would engage in that conversation. I believe that we have an email that specifically discusses the methodology in that article, and folks have agreed that the methodology in that particular study drastically overinflates and would overestimate the amount of assisted living in Minnesota. Having said that, the issue on mandatory transitional consultation is slightly different. That particular, and we certainly will talk about the concentration later on, the issue of mandatory transitional consultation is really about how many steps we're going to require seniors to go through before they enter into and choose housing with services as an option for long-term care. We think it goes too far when we require seniors to get a certificate from the government before they can enter into these contracts. Quite frankly, some would portray it as ageism, and others would see it as a way of diverting folks from these choices. And so that's really the issue and the concern that we have with this particular bill. But we'd certainly be happy to get more information on your question if that's the committee's desire.
Mr. Chair, would it be appropriate right now for me to move my oral amendment?
Sure.
I'm looking at the same sheet that you're looking at as well, and I'm wondering if there was some correlation with us closing down a nursing home to having more assisted living, and so that's something that I would like to see further, you know, if we were to get more data on this. But I'm not going to add on to what Ms. Sterlo has already said. I just want to add a little piece that some of the minority or cultural specific providers, it's going to be a tremendous difficulty for them because they don't understand the system and the language barrier. Many of the facilities or the providers end up doing a lot of the paperwork, end up being a social worker for these families who need the services, and so this is just another addition to it. So without further ado, I'd like to delete Section 5 and 13.
Okay, the motion is to delete Sections 5 and 13. And just to be clear on what this is everybody, notwithstanding whether they get public help or not, essentially.
Perfect.
Yeah. All right. Seeing no further discussion on that motion, all in favor of the motion say aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed? Motion prevails. Okay.
Mr. Chair, before I turn the discussion over to Ms. Bahi to more specifically discuss the provision and one of the provisions in the bill that we do support, which is Section 19, the repeal of rate equalization, I just want to quickly provide some framing remarks. The long-term care imperative strongly believes that the elimination of rate equalization is a longer-term financing reform initiative that recognizes the importance of personal responsibility. Phase out of rate equalization law would be an important recognition of the fact that cost of caring for our growing senior population must be a shared responsibility between individuals and the public sector. It is, we believe, the beginning and not the end to a conversation that we must have sooner rather than later about long-term care financing reform. We know we've spoken to many members of the committee and have distributed a document called Changes Imperative that outlines our vision for financing reform. But we do view this as an important first step, and I believe that we've provided two pieces of information in your packet that also provide that information. Now, without further delay, I'll turn it over to Ms. Bahi for some additional comments regarding to the rate equalization provision of the bill.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. As Ms. Thurlow stated, my name is Christine Bahi, and I'm the administrator at St. Benedict Senior Community in St. Cloud. I've been an administrator for over 13 years and have been with St. Benedict for about a year and a half. Our community is not just a nursing home, but we also provide the entire spectrum of care from independent housing, subsidized housing, assisted living, memory care. In our care center, we have diversified our services over the years in order to make up for the losses that we have sustained on the medical assistance program. Right now, 18% of our resident days are paid through the Medicare program, and it is only that program that allows us to be financially sustainable at this point. This past year, we sustained cuts to our Medicare rates, and we are facing further cuts to Medicare in the next years. 82% of my resident days are controlled by the state of Minnesota in the rate setting area. We are paid $20 a day less than what our costs are. And it is only Medicare that makes up that difference. 38% of my resident days are private pay, which is a high percentage. However, without rate equalization and in light of cuts that we may be facing, I will have no alternative but to look at my highest cost center in making up these losses if rate equalization does not happen, if the repeal does not happen, and that is in staff wages and benefits. And we all know that when you cut your staff in a healthcare setting, the only people that impacts are your residents and the quality of the care that they receive and the quality of their life. It is already difficult to find staff who truly care and are truly, truly committed to the work, because they can easily go into a hospital setting and make anywhere from $5 an hour to $20 an hour more doing the same exact work. There are many people who oppose the repeal of rate equalization for many reasons. I do not believe these reasons are valid after my years in the industry. One of the reasons I hear is because of discrimination, that we would discriminate as providers in our provision of care, in our admission policies, in our discharge policies, or our transfer policies. That is governed by federal law.
and our conditions of participation in 483.12, Section C1, it is very clear that we cannot discriminate against that. We would be in violation of our conditions to participate in Medicare and medical assistance. We also have... The Minnesota Department of Health also surveys us every single year. They are contracted to do the federal certification survey for us. We have federal deficiencies that start at F-150 and go all the way to F-522. That covers everything from quality of care, the services we provide, physician services, medications, and environment. People often refer to the MA ghettos that were once reality in nursing homes. I guarantee you, the surveyors in Minnesota will survey us the same, whether equalization is repealed or not. They will apply the same minimum standard to every resident without regard to payment source. And we must provide service without regard to payment source. Other people talk about it'll accelerate payment spend down, that we will prematurely impoverish people. I have to tell you, before I came, I looked at what my length of stay was last month in long-term care. Of the people that discharged last month, my length of stay was 34 days. 34 days. We will not prematurely impoverish people at those rates. People are choosing to not come to nursing homes. There are alternatives in the community today. They come at their very last days, the very end of the line when they can't be anywhere else. And the average in Minnesota, the average length of stay for long-term care is 268 days, and that is rapidly declining every single year. That is less than 8 months in a nursing home for the average person. Cost shifting is another argument that we hear, that we will shift the costs in order to cover for Medicaid over to our private paying residents. People should pay their costs. People should pay what it costs us to provide a service. We have watched our nursing homes deteriorate because we can't make a profit. Our buildings are deteriorating to the point that nobody wants to come to them. We have equipment that is falling apart because we can't afford to replace it. We defer these upgrades because we have to pay our staff. We have to buy food and we have to pay the electric bill. I don't know of any other healthcare setting where they have to provide the Medicaid discount to a private paying customer. Hospitals, they offer people a reduction of their charges. Their charges are not cost. Nowhere in society do I get a discount when the government contracts with a supplier. I don't get the discount that the government gets. So I question why it is in a nursing home that people who can afford to pay their share of the true cost, they're not paying it. None of us get discounts elsewhere. None of us. Equalization does not encourage people to plan. It's not encouraging me to plan. As a matter of fact, I sit and think about my parents who are 65 years old now. And should we move their assets into a family trust or into my name? So that in 10 years, if they need to be in a nursing home, heaven forbid, the state can pay for it? That's the incentive we are creating with equalization. People do not come to nursing homes. Nobody here wants to be in a nursing home unless they absolutely have to be. We have options in the community. Equalization will not shift costs. It will not make people spend down faster. We will not discriminate. We are in this business because we care about people. We do it because we care for our elders. We want to provide a good place for them. I will open it up for questions as you choose. Just for an example, though, a phase of rate equalization at 2% means less than $3.50 a day. In my building, it's less than $3.50 a day. That's $120 a month. That is not a high cost for the service that they're getting. Thank you.
Thank you. What's the average length of stay now for somebody in nursing homes? I'm sure it's different for different categories of patients, but
it is. For short stay residents, we're typically seeing around 30 days, and those are people who are returning back to their home environment. Long-term care, last we saw it was at 268 days. Last year, my average was around 212 days, so I had a very unusual month last month.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, if I can amplify that answer. And Representative Liebling, the statewide median length of stay in Minnesota is now down to 28 days in a care center.
Further questions? Representative Laughlin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Chair Witness. I know there's a big range. I'm wondering to what degree the rate of equalization is would apply to what percent, because you have so many post-surgery rehabs now in nursing homes. We've really kind of changed the function of the industry, but I'm thinking in terms of how we utilize it. It seems like more people are spending longer time in assisted living or at home and home care, and so you know, it seems like the long-term residents are primarily Alzheimer's, dementia, those sorts of chronic issues. But can you tell me, like, industry average or within your facility, what percent are the traditional long-term care clients as opposed to the post-surgical recovery?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We have 44 of our beds that are designated for short stay, so it's about 20% of our facility is dedicated to short stay, and the rest of it goes to long-term care.
Mr. Pearson.
Mr. Chair, members, for the record, Toby Pearson, Care Providers in Minnesota. I think as the industry as a whole, I think it ends up being about 25% of the days are private pay days. So you have about 20% that is Medicare, and you have a big chunk that is MA, and then you have the last part portion, which is private pay as a whole.
And
Mr. Chair, just so I'm clear on terminology, when you say private pay, that would include health insurer paid care as well as someone who is paying out of pocket? Or how do you consider when somebody's covered by their health insurance plan?
Mr. Chair, we actually, the health insurance tend to only pay through the short stay program. And so when I refer to our private pay, I am truly referring to people who are spending their assets.
Okay. Other questions on this subject? Okay. Thank you very much.
Mr. Chair, members, again, my name is Toby Pearson with Care Providers of Minnesota. I'll just cover a couple things very briefly.
So if people have their cell phones on, yeah, it seems like we have to turn them off in this room. So please, I'm sure that's what's causing that. Go ahead.
First, I'd like to say that we oppose the proposed cuts to older adult services in House File 3442. We oppose them because of the adverse economic impact of the cuts. As you know, investments in long-term care strengthen our economy and protect our seniors. Long-term care supports 112,600 jobs in the state of Minnesota. Long-term care is responsible for a total of $6.7 billion contribution to the state of Minnesota. In short, in many communities, older adult service providers are a vital economic engine and one of the largest employers in rural Minnesota. As far as the rate reductions, I'd just like to keep it at the policy level of the rate reductions and not get into the intricacies. I assume that will be handled in finance. The big concern that we have is informed by the manner of the cuts to older adult services. First, on the housing with services side, the payment rates for customized living are decreased according to concentration. You briefly touched on this earlier, but we do have serious questions as to the validity of using concentration as the only factor for presenting cuts. First, as was touched on by Representative Tao, there might be an example where the population does not have an alternative, such as a nursing home. And therefore a different mix and density of the population is in that community. Minnesota has long been one who has been leaders in trying to push folks into the position of making a choice of where they want to be. If it's a home and community-based setting that's better for them and more efficient for us from a payer perspective and the state level, then that is the position that we would like to see them in. So the concentration by itself is not necessarily a true indicator. Another question we have with the using a concentration is how does that fit with the CMS waiver requirement of the uniform tool process that the department is currently changing over to. Under that, all of our providers are changing to using this uniform tool for payment. The payment is based on the needs of the individual. So the density would factor in a different payer source when we're supposed to be moving to a uniform tool. So I'm not sure how that would have to be ironed out by somebody between CMS and our waiver application, but as all of our payers are moving over towards that, artificially picking one indicator seems like an inefficient way to pick your choice. While we recognize that you have difficult financial times, it has always been the position of the imperative that if there are cuts, the cuts should be as shallow as possible, spread across as many as possible. Share the pain evenly. This bill deviates from that policy position, and therefore we oppose the policy of the cutting in this proposal. The size of the cuts and the fact that these proposals come on top of previous cuts as well as on allotments in the Housing with Services area is a matter that we would address in the Finance Committee. For the nursing homes, resorting to the policy of cuts based on percent of private payers is troublesome. First, as long as the policy of rate equalization is in place, the relevance of picking private payers is questionable. Finally, the policy of picking winners and losers is a road that associations simply cannot go down. Again, while we recognize that you have difficult financial times, we encourage the share the pain evenly, make the cuts as shallow as possible, spread across as many as possible. To the extent that this bill deviates from that policy as far as payment, implementing of cuts, we oppose those policy changes. Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I stand for any questions.
So if rate equalization is repealed, does that change your position on the nursing home private pay?
Mr. Chair, no, I don't think it would. Because again, you're picking winners and losers based on who is going to be a private payer in certain communities. Within those communities, needs to be a sensitivity to the variation of the folks who live there.
So is your opposition to these things just because you're an association representing a bunch of different facilities? And so philosophically, you can't pick and choose winners and losers? I mean, we've had this conversation now for 2 years about how can we make these cuts in a way that, you know, there's some of your folks that are doing fine and making a profit, and there's some of your folks that are on the verge of closing or have closed. And, you know, we talked about the critical access nursing home concept. We're talking about this concept. And we seem to get no assistance coming back telling us how can we distinguish among these folks so that those folks that are on the verge of closing don't get hit as hard as the ones that aren't, or where we need nursing homes because of a lack of other alternatives, we can help those folks out. And we've been struggling with that, and I just don't feel like we're getting any. And I know that's what Representative Hosh was trying to do with the Medicare piece here as well, which apparently didn't pan out. But
Mr. Chair, so members, I think there's a couple answers to that question. First, obviously, as representing associations, we have a challenge in that if you're picking winners and losers within your association, that's really not going to be that good for anybody in the association. Because the challenge is then who's next. If you're pointing to them, saying cut them, eventually the line runs out and you're the one getting pointed at. The other is, I think we did take big steps towards achieving that when we were looking at cost coverage and covering people's costs, because there are different costs across the state. And so when we started to move towards the rebasing, we were actually looking at covering people's costs and using that as a payment mechanism that would move towards leveling
That's fair.
And addressing that issue.
And that needs money.
Yes, Mr. Chair, and if you'd like to make a motion for us to put
Okay. All right. Any other questions for the witness? Representative Laughlin.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. And I guess I just want to put in the discussion as we talk about rate equalization, you know, one of the issues that we have is the growth in MA utilization amongst this population. Part of it is demographics. Part of it, as we all know, is about asset transfers. And, you know, we had in a bill yesterday take out some language that we put in that was trying to tighten that up because the federal government under the previous administration at least was not willing to be our partner in getting rid of that inequity. And we all know in our own communities and people we've encountered in our life of people who are able to afford attorneys and transfer their assets to the next generation to their favorite cause or to get a room name for them in some building, and then have their loved ones go on medical assistance
And others who have seen their entire life savings, because they just don't live life that way, go into the care of their loved one in their final days. And that creates, I think, the biggest inequity. And so, to me, this, if we were to do, repeal rate equalization, we create even more incentive for people to feel justified in transferring assets in order to be unfairly eligible for medical assistance. Because they're going to say, it's not fair. Because if I go into the nursing home down the block, I'm going to have to pay out of my pocket 10%, 5%, 20% more than the person who gave away all their stuff or is on the public dole. And I think we're going to actually, maybe we'll short-term save some money and help financially with individual institutions, but we are going to definitely create bigger budget problems for us down the line. And we're going to give more people who are uncomfortable with this whole discussion more justification in their own mind to feel like they're just playing the game like everyone else, and they're not going to get ripped off by having to pay more than the person who's on, quote, welfare. And I think we have to think about that in this context. I have seniors who tell me that, you know, when they were younger, they used to get, you know, 3 credit card offers a day in the mail, and now they get 3 invitations to lunch a week from some legal entity who wants to teach them how to play the game and how it's just fair and it's responsible planning. And I think that we can't discuss rate equalization outside of that other impact, because I think that is one of the biggest cost drivers. And it's not the it's not the problem of the industry. It's about individual choices of individuals across the state. But I really do think that given the demographics and given the budgets that we face today and we're going to face in the future, I don't think that repealing that right now is a good direction until we have a better understanding of its long-term implications.
Mr. Chair.
Just very briefly, Representative Loeffler, we agree that this is part of a broader conversation, that the repeal of rate equalization, as I said, we view it as a step towards changing the entire paradigm and the way we approach financing long-term care. Part of it is changing mindsets, and you are absolutely right that we have created a system that does not encourage people to save for their long-term care needs. Even though Minnesota has one of the higher take-up rates of long-term care insurance in the nation, it still hovers around 10%. And you're right, folks are not in the mindset. Folks from my generation and older generations are not planning for and saving for their long-term care needs. We believe that a phase-in approach of repealing rate equalization somewhat buys us some time to continue the rest of that conversation, whether it's looking at tools to get people the tools that they need to start saving. I know that there are members on this committee that have looked at a variety of options for financing reform, and we have also engaged in other stakeholder activities to talk about that with the Minnesota Citizens League, with the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce, and we remain committed to also addressing those other parts of the conversation so that it's not just about repealing rate equalization, it's also getting people to actually engage in saving for and planning for their long-term care needs. So again, we believe that the repeal that's proposed in Representative Hosh's bill is the start to a conversation and certainly not the end of a very long conversation.
Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Loeffler, I just wanted to say, you know, certainly you're asking some good questions, but no, it strikes me that we're one of, 2 states that have rate equalization? And so certainly there must be some experience in other places that we can look to answer some of these questions. And I just wonder if anybody has looked at any data or examined this question about whether, I don't know if other places have had rate equalization and repeal it. Probably not. It's more just that they never did it in the first place. But, you know, whether there's a higher rate of assets being hidden, whether people are, you know, what the experience is of the private pay folks, you know, how does this all play out? I mean, we're not operating here totally in the dark. We have the experience of all these other states to look to, and what does that tell us? I don't think we need to, you know, frankly, I kind of, you know, this is a difficult issue. There's no question about it. We're not going to make this kind of change or not make the change without consequences. there's no question about that, but I don't think we're completely in the dark here. There must be something to look to. Do you have any of that information?
Ms. Thule.
Mr. Chair, Representative Liebling, I can tell you this. There are conversations about long-term care financing reform going around on all over the country. That this is, that it's not just Minnesota that's facing an age wave, although we are tending to age faster than other parts of the country. And so I think a lot of people are looking...
It's the weather.
I think a lot of different states are experimenting with a lot of different options. As to specifics, we'd be happy to bring additional information to your office. I can tell you states like Washington, Nebraska, Hawaii have all looked at different state models that would encourage or change financing reform. Also at the national level, there have been discussions about different approaches. And different stakeholders, whether it's consumers, insurance companies, providers, are all really struggling with this. So you're right. There's a lot of information out here. We're not operating in the dark. And it's just a question of what's the best fit for Minnesota, I think, is the next stage in the conversation. But we'd be happy to engage and show the research that we have for you. I don't have it with me today, and I apologize. But we'd be happy to continue that conversation.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, and this is the part of this bill, and I mean this genuinely, Larry. I mean, this is great. We need to get on this journey, and I'm sure there's some bipartisan support around the table on this. Rate equalization is hurting our nursing homes right now, and this is a responsible first step. I really appreciate Representative Hosh bringing it forward. And we've talked at several forums. I know I've spoken at them on panels where we've talked about the fact that we've got a system in our state where the default when a financial planner sits down with a person who's aging and tells them, get rid of your assets so you can go on medical assistance. I mean, that is a default in our state in a lot of cases, and the kind of conversations financial planners are having with elderly people. So we need to look at how we deal with assets. Representative Loeffler, you raised some good questions, but then we need to look at how we're incenting people to do that, along with this whole rate equalization issue, and figure out the pieces that need to fall into place to prevent that. I should have an incentive at my age, late 40s, to begin saving for my retirement, to begin putting aside some money.
Should have done it a long time ago.
I know that. If we had passed my long-term care tax credit bill 2 years ago, I'd probably have long-term care right now, but you're absolutely right. A lot of us are probably in that boat.
You don't?
But this is, I don't right now, I don't. And that's, I mean, I'm part of the problem, see? But this has got to get dealt with, because not only is it a financial issue, you know, a lot of people on our side of the aisle get accused of dealing with only finances, but it's a sustainability issue. What we're doing right now is forcing people into situations they shouldn't have to be in. And where there are opportunities for people to use their existing assets appropriately to provide nursing home care, we ought to be allowing that to happen and helping it happen for the sake of our nursing homes and for the residents who need to live there. So this is a great first step. I appreciate Representative Hosh. He's been a leader on that in the legislature, and I do appreciate that. But we need to figure out the things you're mentioning, Representative Loeffler. We need to figure out what is it that's causing people to dump their assets. And if that would be done unfairly by removing rate equalization, then let's put something in place that fixes that.
Well,
thank you, Mr. Chair. And the other thing is that we don't have, and we need to step up and do, it's not just about financing, because quite honestly, a lot of people who have long-term care insurance policies are abandoning it just when they get to the time of need, because they can't afford their premiums and their heat and property tax bills and other things. And so it is not the answer for everybody, because a lot of policies are being dropped just at the time of need because they can't sustain them once they get into retirement. But the other problem we have is we have not really done a comprehensive look at what we need in a nursing home industry, what we need in assisted living, what we need in home care. We just sort of let it evolve. And we got into trouble 25 years ago. We led the nation in the most number of nursing home beds in the nation. We were putting people into nursing homes that maybe didn't need that level of care because we overbuilt. Now we're looking at things that show that we have way overbuilt in assisted living, and they're still going up. I know of at least three within 10 miles of my house that are on the drawing boards. Whether they're going to be able to succeed in this economy and with the demographics, I'm not sure. But and so we haven't, I don't think, right-sized it. At the same time, we're losing some of the nursing homes that we critically need in certain geographic areas of the state. And for those that specialized in dealing with certain types of populations, with behavior challenges, those sorts of things, those are the ones that are going out of business because they're not as, or they're in old locations, their physical plant is not very attractive in the competitive market. And I don't think we're right-sizing it anywhere. We may still have way too many nursing home beds in some part of the state and way too little in another. The population has really shifted. And where our workforce for the future is going to be to operate any of these is really a question. 70% of the births in Minnesota are in the 7-county metro area. I mean, where are we going to find the young workforce to staff these in the future? I think we're really going to have to look at what models are sustainable and do a more comprehensive plan. That isn't going to help us with this year's budget, but I do feel like I have great empathy for anyone who's in the business because you're dealing with lots and lots of changes, and you're unfortunately having to be subject to a lot of financial risk with the state partnership.
Just to that point, I think you make some good points, Representative Loeffler, but then I think about, I think Representative Kelly had a bill in Red Wing. They wanted to realign how they provided services so that they could provide them better in a more cost-effective way, and they weren't allowed to just go ahead and do that. They had to come to us, ask for legislation, get legislation granted to give them flexibility. And so I agree with you that we need to take a look, but we need to also be careful that it is absolutely government-driven and more about providing flexibility, because I believe that the folks in Red Wing know their market better than the people in this room. And so if we're going to do that, we should make sure we do it with an eye to flexibility and responding to market needs, because I do think the market needs are an important component of making sure that we have that spectrum available in areas throughout the state. But that's just one example, I think, that jumps out to me as government getting in the way of actually using dollars better and providing better services. And so I hope that we can have both sides of that discussion, because I think they're both important.
Well, Mr. Chair, the other thing that is an issue with the overbuilding of assisted living is that people are spending down their assets at that stage before they really need the high end. And the marketing, because we're overbuilt in certain communities, is to populations that don't have significant needs. And, you know, my mother-in-law wanted to move into one just because she thought it looked like fun. She could order off a menu, and they had a card game that she wouldn't have to drive to. And we talked to her about how her family lives into the 90s, and she could certainly make that choice, but she would run out of money within a few years. And what would she do at that point, and was she comfortable with those choices? And she ended up living another 10 years and was, I think, happy with the choice that she'd made to delay that step. But, you know, it's tough choices.
Representative Root.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm wondering, would you have information as far as the geographic distribution of these facilities and also what their payer mix is and whether they're, you know, the percentage, or is that something that would not be? I don't know if you're the proper person to ask, but.
Mr. Chair, Representative Root, if we could just get a clarification, are you talking about the care centers or the assisted living?
Assisted living.
Mr. Chair, members, not all assisted livings are necessarily members of either association. We can certainly do a map of the association assisted livings that we would represent. I'm not sure if the department would have a better listing of who and where and how many units are involved in each community.
Representative Hosh might have some information.
Representative Rue, that is the very reason we're here today, because we're just trying to explore the information that has and ideas before us, and because of this bill, the department is working on those densities, what that means, how that's going to impact not only the counties but regions and the whole works, and that's what we need to know. I'm not sure if these ideas are going to stick. We're throwing wet toilet paper on the wall. You know, some of it's going to stick and some of it might not. And we need to have that discussion. And I mean, in all honesty, ideally, I hope none of these things become law.
But I want to make sure we have that discussion and be correct. We have decisions between bad and worse. And I don't want to make the worst of the decisions. I want to make the ones that are least bad. And that's the discussion of the bill, and that very information you're asking about is what we need to get.
I think we'll have more insight from other testifiers here as well. Thank you. Ms. Henry.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I will try to be brief. I want to talk mainly about the PCA provisions, which are in Section 11 and Section 12, and then just weigh in very briefly on rate equalization. We are very, very opposed and worried about accelerating the PCA cuts, which is what Section 11 does. There are, as you all know, there were substantial changes to the PCA program last session, plus a lot of integrity changes and management changes for the department, which we certainly supported. The cuts that were made last session are tiered, and substantial cuts have started in January with a new assessment. People are getting hours reduced, and some people are being terminated. The proposal in Section 11 would accelerate cuts that are really that are now scheduled for July of 2011, and we think that would just be an incredible problem. It looks like from preliminary data that a lot more people would be cut off than the department estimated last year. For the data we had from last year showed that about 1,600 would get cut off when the second tier of cuts occur. It looks from preliminary data like it's going to be more like 2,400. We don't know that yet. But the folks who are dealing with the PCA cuts that have just been imposed are now rearranging their lives because of the cuts and trying to get by. And then in a few more months, 2,400 of them would be eliminated totally, which I think would just be quite a crisis in many families and in many counties.
So can you just explain to us what would cause people to fall off?
The criteria for
I guess.
Yes, Mr. Chair, the criteria for eligibility changes. Right now, people are eligible because they either have a dependency in an activity of daily living, or they have a level one behavior, which is the most serious kind of behavior, dangerous to yourself, others, or property destruction. In July of 11, as the law stands now, and as it would be accelerated here to this July, people would be cut off if they did not have dependencies in two activities of daily living, and no one who was getting PCA service because of level one behavior would be eligible anymore. So we are targeting here a lot of people with behavioral issues across the spectrum, developmental disabilities, autism, people with brain injury, and folks with mental illness as well, because they don't necessarily have the physical issues that would lead to the dependency in ADLs, activities of daily living, but they are getting PCA service at this point.
And the alternative for those people would be waivers?
The alternative for people that we have right now would be home and community waivers, maybe some other home health services. But of course, as you all know, the home and community waiver caseload has been limited nearly every year starting in 2002 because of our budget. So it isn't really an alternative that's available. But the legislature last year required the department to develop an alternative for the people who would be cut off in 2011. The folks who don't have two activities of daily living but may have behavioral issues or other needs. And there was money set aside to do that. Those alternative services are not going to be ready this July. So a lot of people and families are going to be without. We're hearing at this point from a lot of adoptive families of sibling groups with kids that are just saying, when we adopted our children, we were told we got medical assistance, and the PCA program is what's giving us another adult pair of hands to manage so that we can parent these kids into adulthood. Without this service, I don't know what we're going to do. And these folks right now are coping with cuts in hours. they're going to be all, you know, a lot of them are going to simply be terminated, a lot of kids with fetal alcohol and other things. So it's a really serious problem. The second PCA section is charging PCAs $50 a year to enroll. That is really cruel. We need PCAs. They make little money. They have very hard work to do. And I mean, it's difficult, I think, for the PCAs, but I think we would also risk losing people that just don't have the money. As it is, the changes we made last year, which we strongly support, require PCAs to get training. But now agencies are requiring the PCAs on their own time to get training and certified before they're employed. So they're already having to invest to be a PCA. And $50 more is not a good idea.
And can I just, so the department is here, I'm assuming, for this. Are you guys taking notes? You want to respond to some of this, not just this, but kind of the whole testimony at the end. You're not signed up, but I think that would be helpful.
Okay, the third point, just quickly, radicalization. Of course, at Legal Aid, we represent low-income people. We think it's the wrong policy path for our state. We totally understand the fiscal reasons for it. I think just two points are important. Number one, there are about 2,000 people with disabilities under 65 that are in our nursing facilities now. You know, that they are there, they have had lives of poverty, and that's where they are. The other point I would make is I briefly checked with the senior attorneys in our office who represent seniors, and they're concerned about it, and they pointed to two experiences they've had within the last year in assisted living. One was pretty abruptly, the people on the elderly waiver in one facility all had to move to smaller rooms, and the second experience they've had, and of course we don't have radicalization in assisted living. The second experience they had is that when they went out to a training, they were told by some of the residents that they should come and see their dining room because they were in the dining room of the private pay people, because they had a dining room for, you know, the way the person put it was the poor dining room. So our concerns, and these things have happened in other states, and I think Representative Liebling asked a very good question, and I will go back and ask them. I think there have been some reports, and I don't know that it's more on what happens to people in states in terms of different kinds of treatment and what are some remedies to take if you see problems. But that's our
perspective. These are in assisted livings?
Yes.
And what about the Medicare and Medicaid federal requirement protections? That wouldn't apply
to assisted living. And
have you seen cases? Well, maybe this is something you got to look in other states too.
Right.
Where those have been challenged, where that law has been used to challenge discriminatory treatment.
Definitely, and I will get to our people who practice in the area of seniors and get back to the committee with some information.
That'd be helpful. Thank you. For the witness. I do have one question before you go, but are there others? Representative Loeffler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Ms. Henry, you always give us good insights. One of the things I've thought about as we try and reduce costs, which is what this whole discussion is about, is for most children, PCA services is one-on-one. And I'm wondering whether or not you can envision models for certain groups of children in which group after school child care, for example, might be appropriate, more mainstreamed, have a better sense of opportunities and another learning environment, as opposed to sending PCAs to each house individually, because that to me is a very, very expensive model, and it's appropriate for some children, I suspect, who could not deal with that many hours of stimulation in a day, but I suspect for others it quite honestly would be a welcome change. And for their parents to have, you know, that security of not having, some people I know have cycled through all kinds of PCAs and had not inconsistent care for their children just because it's been hard to retain them for those limited after-school hours. I encourage you and the people that you work with to look at alternative models, because I think that's going to be the long-term solution. Because we may not be able to have personalized services as the only model available.
Mr. Chair and Representative Loeffler. Yes, we absolutely support that, and in fact sought legislation to get a report on services for youth with disabilities to do exactly this, and there is a report, and I'll be sure you get it. There are some barriers to doing it, but some really creative providers down in Winona County are doing just this with good results. So we definitely support those ideas. And just one other thing, it is possible to do shared care with up to three children with disabilities on the PCA program now.
So the only question I have, there's another issue that has come up, or kind of logistical challenge with providers of PCA services and housing services. Is that still out there, or have we addressed that?
Mr. Chair, the legislation that was passed last year prohibits a housing provider from also being the PCA provider. And that goes into, I believe the assessments now that are occurring, about a third of them have occurred, are telling people if they're in that situation that they are going to have to move or get a different provider. So.
And are there places in the state where there's just not, I mean, is this an access issue? Places in the state where the only provider of PCA services is also the housing services provider?
Mr. Chair, we don't know that yet. I'm sorry to say. I think people, because they don't have to deal with that really, I think, until August. People are dealing with the hours cuts and determinations, and those are the folks calling us right now. But we certainly heard of concerns. Unfortunately, I think the department would be in a better position, but they said last year they didn't really know how many of these there were and where they were.
All right. Thank you. All right. Jane and Mr. McAfee. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is Jane Oprimovich, but I would like Mr. McAfee to testify first, please.
Wonderful. Welcome to the committee.
Mr. Chair, representatives, my name is Al McAfee. I grew up during the Great Depression. I served in World War II in the Navy. I went to college on the GI Bill. I became a high school business education and economics teacher. I taught in Warroad, Leroy, and Roseville. I also had a locksmith business, and I'm now retired. Alice, my wife of 61 years, worked as a legal secretary. She was an accountant and federal program officer. After many years of retirement, Alice developed dementia. I took care of her home for about a year and a half, as long as I could. But finally, we decided to place her in a nursing home, where she has lived for 3 years. Over these past three years, I've gone up to the home every day, and lately it's twice a day. I help her eat. I also help other people. It's about 20 hours a week. I help Alice and a lot of her residents. My son and daughter come up once a week or maybe twice a week, and when they go, I don't go up. I've taken two trips out of state, but I prefer to be with Alice. Alice and I, we've served and saved, and at the nursing home, we're private payers. We have long-term care insurance, which pays for part of the cost of some of the care. We use our pensions and Social Security and savings to make up the difference. And I can tell you how that goes. I want to make 3 points about House File 3442 affecting long-term care. One, following the governor's proposal to repeal rate equalization is unfair and short-sighted. Asking Alice and I to pay more is unfair. It will drain our money faster and push her forward to medical assistance. In the long run, this will drive up the state's cost. If we want more people to buy long-term care insurance, this sends the wrong message. Cutting rates will likely cause staff cuts and worse care in our nursing home and others across the state. nursing homes become more, become less safe, more falls and unnecessary deaths may occur. As much as I love Alice, my wife, I can't do it alone. Please keep rate equalization in place and oppose the cuts to nursing homes. Thank you.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and committee members. My name is Jane Oprimovich. I am the president of the Seniors and Workers for Quality Coalition and a volunteer with the Alzheimer's Association and have been a consumer of long-term care services for my mother. As a representative of the Seniors and Workers Coalition, the people at the heart of long-term care, I'm challenging the proposal that lays the burden of solving Minnesota's long-term care budget crisis on the seniors and workers. To illustrate, the yearly tax on nursing assistance, euphemistically called a registration fee, of $50 means that an individual would have to work at least a whole shift to pay that sum. Many of these people who have to use food shelves now because of their low pay would pay this fee to the general fund with no guarantee that nursing homes or assisted living facilities will see a benefit. How does this help the quality of care in these facilities? Mr. McAvey has already told you how the removal of rate equalization would affect his family. Our concern is that the supposed increase in revenue that this will bring will not mean a stable, well-trained staff to provide care. However, of greatest concern in eliminating rate equalization is the looming possibility that nursing homes will pick and choose from the waiting list for admissions based on the ability to pay. I'd like to stop here for a moment from my written testimony and remind you about 3 weeks ago that I did speak to the committee and some of you were here, and I reminded you that my mother, who was in a nursing home in Ohio, had been in the facility for over 4 years, and on her third hospital discharge, they refused to take her back. My brother walked into the facility and said, "How can you tell me you can't accept her?" And they said, "Well, we don't have any rooms." He walked up and down the hall. He said, "You have a room. I expect her, you to find a bed for her," because there were empty rooms. It's because she had been on MA, exactly. Because of the current non-discrimination clause, rate equalization is the protector of those whose funds have been drained. This bill also regulates consumers more than providers when it stipulates that regardless of payer source, the consumer must consult the senior linkage line before a move into housing with services. I just recalled during the testimony today, a reminder here, senior linkage line has limited hours, 8 to 5, Monday through Friday. Good heavens forbid that you're being discharged on a weekend and you need to go into housing with services. While consultation with the senior linkage line is commendable and it is desirable for most consumers, it is not necessary for all. This bill will levy a new surtax on the seniors who have been able to save some money for their care until their savings are gone, while imposing fees on the nursing assistants and the personal care attendants who care for them. I sincerely hope that the committee will not vote favorably on this bill in its present form, and even amending this bill will still leave many dire circumstances. Yes, we do need to look for additional revenue sources, but let's not burden the already strapped workers and our seniors who expected to take care of themselves as long as possible. Please return to the drawing board. The options are understandably limited, but this proposal is a slap in the face of seniors and workers. I thank you for the opportunity to express our concerns, and we're ready to provide any additional information we can.
Senator Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is really tough stuff. I think everybody in the room understands that. I just would ask you to avoid rhetoric like a slap in the face to seniors. That doesn't help us. We all want to do the best we can, and I appreciated the chair's comments before because, I look at this, I have to tell you this, not just in this area, but in everything we're doing this year, the question that I keep saying to myself is, how can we do the least harm to our state? Not even what's fair, as though everybody deserves the same, we got cut before, don't cut us this time. That, to me, is not what this is about. This is about how can we as a state provide essential service to people that need it.
Correct.
And, you know, if we lift rate equalization, I hope that seniors will understand that it is not a slap in the face, that we're trying to make sure that nursing homes remain open, that care is available for people. And I understand that it can, for some people, it can be really tough. You know, there are no easy answers here. But I just would ask us all to stay away from that kind of rhetoric, if you would. And then I do also have a question for Mr. McAbee, is it?
Yes.
You know, and I appreciate your coming and telling us about your situation. And I, you know, I in no way mean to be unsympathetic to it. And I think it's wonderful that you're there taking care of your wife. And that is really admirable. What I'd like to know is, you know, you're talking about your private pay, and someone mentioned before that if we, the 2% might be an extra $350 a day, I think somebody said. What do you, if the rate equalization was lifted and it was another 2%, say, what, do you know how much more that would cost, and how soon would your assets be used up under those circumstances? I don't know if you're prepared to tell us that.
Mr. McAbee.
Not very fair to do that.
I apologize. If you know.
Well, it could go $3,000 a year. I don't know.
Excuse me. There's a Senator, Mr. Chair, and Representative Liebling. Part of the difficulty is that some of the things we haven't discussed here is, for example, when the nursing home administrator said it would be another $3.52 a day. There's a case mix for all of these individuals, and each person is paying a different rate. For someone with Alzheimer's disease, the case rate, I know a former board member of the Alzheimer's Association told me, and this is 5 years ago, he pays $6,000 a month now for his wife's case mix because she'd been moved to a higher level on it. And that was 4 years ago. She's in late stages right now and on hospice care. And this is a reminder again that some of our patients, especially those with dementia, the Alzheimer's form or others, there's no other recourse except a nursing home, a skilled care facility.
Sure, Mr. Chair.
Yeah, absolutely.
Thank you. And fair enough. I don't mean to put you on the spot. I'm just, if you know, that's all. And, you know, it's fine. And you know what? We don't know the answer. It's a fair answer. And I don't want to tell you the answer is also fair.
I just know I pay around $6,900 a month, but I get $2,700 from this long-term nursing care. And we paid for that nursing care for 15 years. We planned ahead. We planned. My wife and I are both talented. I was talented. I'm a certified master locksmith. I taught for 32 years. I'm also a musician and played back in the 50s, making money. But we invested our money. We put our money in IRAs. My wife worked for an association where she just took minutes at their meeting. She got $100 a month. She invested that at the end of the 5 years, invested that. So I'm just saying, I thought most people did that. I don't know. I don't understand. Tell me what I should do. Buy a Cadillac? My neighbor went to Hawaii 3 times on his credit card. I went once in World War II. I can understand.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
And I would, Mr. Chair and Representative Liebling, I truly would like to apologize to the committee for those words. But I guess, you know, sometimes our emotions do get away with this. And if we thought, to be honest, if we thought that doing away with rate equalization would solve this problem in a heartbeat, we would say, oh, of course, that's the solution. But I can tell you that in other states who do not have rate equalization, all of those facilities are still saying we need more. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Ms. Kimball. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Good Good evening. I appreciate the opportunity to testify today. Obviously, we are very concerned about several provisions proposed in House File 3442. Of course, I do want to address first up the most serious issue for AARP, our members, and the one most talked about this evening, which is rate equalization and the proposal to repeal it. We do understand that proposals to cut rates to all nursing homes and the negative consequences of those cuts have led long-term care providers and legislators to consider repealing rate equalization as a solution to that problem. We strongly, strongly oppose this, not only because it would result in a major cost shift to residents who pay for their own care, but most importantly, because we believe it could have significant and long-term implications for the quality of care for our most vulnerable population. For all nursing home residents, whether they pay out-of-pocket or whether they receive medical assistance, this is simply unfair, and it will create a different quality system than we have today. I would like to note a couple of things and address a couple of things that were said here. First, we do know just from anecdotal evidence that we have seen in other states around the country that those who are very wealthy and the ones that folks believe, well, you should pay what you can because you've got the money to do it, they're going to spend their money, and they have spent their money, on staying in their own home. They're not going to spend it and hide all of their assets in order to qualify for medical assistance to be in a nursing home. Many of these people don't want to be on medical assistance at all, much less be in a nursing home. And the majority of people, and in the surveys AARP have done since 2003, obviously have shown that they prefer to stay in their own homes and communities. And that's where we need to go with long-term care. Obviously, with our current budget crisis, it's very difficult to do that. But that's where we need to change long-term care. And that needs to happen in another context. I also would point out that 48 other states have unequal rates. Private pay pays significantly more, but there's no evidence that homes survive by paying or by charging the dwindling market of private pay significantly more. I might also note that in the average private pay charge turns out to be, in these other 48 states, turns out to be about $250 a day, which is $100 a day more than what private pay is currently charged here in Minnesota. So there's a significant concern there. I would also urge the committee to consider the fact that that quicker spend down that the majority of hard working Minnesotans will pay, will happen, that quick spend down is going to most likely charge the state or wind up costing the state significantly more. Not only because of the faster spend down, or actually because of the faster spend down, but there are other costs that could be associated with this. Now, we know that back in 2006, there was a fiscal note on Representative Bradley's proposal to do the very same thing, repeal rate equalization. That fiscal note was roughly $9.1 million in 2009. We don't know or understand how this current proposal could be budget neutral, but I would encourage the committee to look at what the differences might be in that fiscal note that was incurred and the fact that there is not a fiscal note this time. We do not believe that repeal of rate equalization would remain budget neutral in out years. So I would encourage the committee to seriously look at the cost to the state of repealing rate equalization, not only the cost to consumers and the average person. I also would note...
So just a couple things.
Yes.
So you said the dwindling number of private pay.
Mm-hmm.
What does that mean?
Well, the dwindling number of individuals nationwide that can afford to pay... in today's economic times.
Is that based on, I knew what, yeah, is that based on something that you've seen? Is there a number of private pay dwindling?
Yes, in fact, it was an AARP study that was done about this, and I'd be happy to share. I don't have that study with me, but I'm happy to share that with the committee. Absolutely. A national AARP study that was done.
Right, okay. And then what about our private room issue? I mean, here, how is that playing out in Minnesota? Because we can charge more, right, for private rooms. Are we seeing this discrimination going on? Are we seeing some of all these bad consequences that we've been talking about going on in that context?
I don't know the answer to that.
Does anybody know the answer to that? Okay, well, we'll take that later on. So, okay, go ahead. Okay, and did you, Mr. Kelly, made a question on this?
Yes, Mr. Chair, just to your point when you asked the question about private pay, because I think this is all about an issue of education, because I can tell you in the financial services industry, one of the things we talk about consistently in retirement planning is the need for the risk level of taking out long-term care insurance, and that is probably the number one risk now entering into the retirement time period. So from as an industry standard, that's what we're all pushing from the position of handling that risk. So I would question that point of the private pay going away. In fact, I would say that that's probably the leading product right now going into retirement to make sure that risk is taken care of. So.
And if I could address that
Absolutely.
Point, Mr. Chair. Thank you. I would note that AARP absolutely supports individuals taking on that risk by encouraging the purchase of private insurance for the payment of long-term care services. One of the problems is that there are not enough affordable products out there that fully cover the increasing costs, and so we would encourage working with the industry to provide products that are more affordable and cover an increasing amount of the cost, and that will help obviously take a lot of pressure off of state government and hopefully reduce the impact. But it will need to be more than that. What we truly need to do is encourage people and really educate them about the need for long-term care insurance from an early age, and thereby we can spread the risk much greater. So that's a problem that absolutely needs to address, and AARP is very, very happy to contribute to that. And
well, the other thing we need to do is actually allow people to have incomes that they can actually afford to save for retirement, and there's way too many people in this country today that can't. Today that can't do that, but that's probably a bigger issue. You know, I also was thinking when you're talking about the private people staying at home, the other thing we could do is actually raise their income tax a little bit and solve some of this problem. But that's aside here too. So, you can go ahead.
Well, and I may note, and I'm very happy to share this information with the committee, that the surveys that AARP that we have done here in the state of Minnesota since 2003 have repeatedly shown that individuals, and I'm not talking about AARP members here, I'm talking about Minnesotans over the age of 18, are willing to pay more in certain types of taxes in order to preserve our current long-term care system, and that includes equal rates. So, and I'm very happy to share that information with you. I also do want to note that we have been reaching out to our members about this very issue, and we've been hearing back from them, and we've got lots of stories, and we're hearing quite a bit from them. We also know that you've been hearing from them, and we've just begun reaching out to folks, and I just do want to note that even within the last 24 hours, more than 300 people have contacted state house representatives to voice their opposition to the repeal of rate equalization.
We know that.
And 691 of them called the governor last week, so just to let you know that.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm really interested in that study of 18-year-olds who are willing to pay more in taxes for long-term care insurance. I'd love to find out about those 18-year-olds because that's fascinating to me. If we can't get 40-year-olds to buy long-term care insurance right now, and that's the argument that's always made, is that we can't get 40-year-olds to buy it, we can't get 50-year-olds to buy it, we can't get 60-year-olds to buy it. I'm curious about this group of 18-year-olds. I think it must be a remarkable group of young men and women. But my question is more related to the point that Representative Thiessen was making related to, you know, this discrimination that we're hearing about. You know, we have many nursing homes that have gone solely to single beds. And so, theoretically speaking, this equalization situation is not there. And so, what's happening in those nursing homes? I think we're talking a lot in theory, but we're not getting down to actually what's happening on the ground. And so, I think that factual information of what's actually going on in our nursing homes is really important, rather than talking about the big picture of what we think might happen. We should know what happens, because we already have that scenario out in the market. In I think is probably working quite well, but I really would be interested in that study. And these are 18-year-olds who probably can't expect any Social Security down the road either.
Mr. Chair, if I could. The study was not about paying for private insurance. It was about preserving our current long-term care system and preserving the current benefits. Yeah. Absolutely. And I'd be very happy to share that with you, and I will. For the record, there were four things they were more than willing to contribute or they felt were taxes that could be and should be levied. One was increasing taxes on households earning more than $250,000. And I'm betting a lot of those 18-year-olds don't make that much, so that was okay. Increasing taxes on cigarettes, liquor, beer, and wine, closing loopholes and exemptions, and allowing more state-run casinos and expanding gaming. So,
how about downloads?
That's not included.
Oh,
we can ask that question I'm sure.
Representative Liebling had a question too, I believe.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to say, going back to the point about all these people who have been emailing us, I was just going to say, if you could please ask them to email only their own representative. Because, it's wonderful that people weigh in, and I think that's a great thing to get people activated, but it's not very helpful to receive 280 emails from people in other places, and I have to say frankly that I don't read them. Can't read them, and then the ones from my own district, I get lost. So that's not a very helpful tactic. I just want to put it out there.
Representative Liebling, we work very hard to ensure that each and every member only hears from their constituents. I'm not sure that the additional emails you're receiving are in fact from us, and if they are, then I apologize, and we'll work hard to ensure that you only hear from your constituents.
Okay, you had other testimony.
Except for the finance chair, you should hear from everybody.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just had one. I think, I know for me at least, and I know we've all been getting a lot of emails, but the majority, in fact, I would almost say everyone, but I can't say with complete certainty, they've all been pretty identical emails, but they've all spoken against this bill on the most part, but have said, with the exception of repealing the rate equalization, most of them had said we would like to see that repealed, keep that part of the bill. So I know, at least for me, and I put them all in a separate folder, and it's well over 200, but I would be surprised if there were more than five that asked us to keep, or asked me to keep rate equalization. So I just wanted to make that point.
So now I know where they're coming from. Okay, go ahead.
I understand, Representative Mack, that the majority of the emails that you have been receiving have actually come from the imperative. I don't believe that we have specifically contacted the constituents in your district, but we would be very happy to.
So,
finally, just a few more points. We do want to say, I do want to make just very clear that we will work with the industry, and we share their concern about the rate cuts. The specific 2.5% proposal is not acceptable, and we are very, very concerned about the impact on the quality of care, because we do believe that staffing would be significantly impacted. So we do have a serious concern there. I also do want to point out very quickly, another proposal that could impact the quality of care is proposed licensing fees for nursing assistants and for housing services establishments. We need good quality trained staff in the long-term care system, and we want to make sure that these do not set up disincentives. I do actually want to thank Representative Hosh and others for removing the certificate of transition consultation. We very much appreciate that. And finally, I do just want to reiterate that we know what a very difficult budget situation we are in right now. If we can do whatever it takes to at least at a minimum maintain the status quo and then begin addressing the more systemic problems that we have in our long-term care system through long-term care reform, that would be the best way to go. So I thank you for the opportunity to testify today.
Thank you. Representative Loeffler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Ms. Kimball and other client advocates in the room and the industry. I'd really like to have a better understanding of the special services provisions, which are on page 16. I don't have any problem with someone charging extra if someone gets, you know, flowers delivered to their room twice a month, you know, those kind of additions. But I think we do need a listing of the kind of things that are allowed and not allowed. And right now, the limitation, it doesn't comply with the current limitations on 16.5 to 16.7, which is you can't change a current service that's included in the rate into a special service, and get, you know, so I think that's a good protection that we ought to bring in if we do this. But I also think saying that it's the minimum to comply with licensure or certification standards, to me, gets a little dicey. Like, we have to feed you, and so if you meet the minimal nutrition standards, you get to go. You get lunch A, which would fit anyone's stereotype of institutional food. But if you pay an extra $400 a month, you actually get a meal you're motivated to eat. Or, you know, I mean, I think we need to have some limitations on what is special services and what is. And I have no problem with having this as an income generator for facilities. But I do think we need to put a little more limits around it, and I welcome the audience's input into doing that if we go this direction.
All right, thank you. Ms. Anderson, and you know, while she's coming up, a lot of people have said they understand the kind of cuts that we're going to have to make this year. I don't think anybody really understands the kind of cuts we're going to have to make this year and next year. And I think the point of this bill, first of all, is to just, this is almost the tip of the iceberg. And so we just have to remember, understand the context that we're in. So go ahead.
Hi, thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. My name is Bridget Linger Anderson, and I'm here. I think I bring a unique perspective because as a member of the CCD, the Direct Support Professional Alliance of Minnesota, and also the Metropolitan Center for Independent Living, I manage the PCA program. I get influenced, and I hear a lot of stories from consumers, DSPs. I have the provider's perspective. I'm here today because I want to talk about Representative Hosh's bill. Two things in particular: moving the eligibility criteria, moving the date to 4 months from now, and then also having the DSPs pay the annual fee of $50 to enroll and renew. The proposal to move the eligibility criteria to July of 2010 will have a devastating impact on the individuals who have non-physical or non-visible disabilities. In testimony today, we've been hearing a lot about how it affects children, and so I want to focus specifically on how it's going to affect individuals with severe and persistent mental illness and other non-visible disabilities. The state of Minnesota does not have the time, a plan, or funding in place to offer cost-effective alternatives to meet basic needs when these services are eliminated. In addition to the consumers being affected, the DSPs, the Direct Support Professionals, or PCAs, will likely be displaced from employment as well. We have to have a plan of support before these changes can be implemented and proposed within 4 months. The outcome of these cuts is that they will actually drive more state spending because the consequences of reduced or eliminated services can mean hospitalization, going into nursing homes, increased unemployment for consumers who can't keep their jobs, and DSPs will no longer have a job. Our counties have already seen a reduction in the number of mental health professional services, including closed clinics and treatment facilities. Our social service infrastructure has been cut to the bone without a site of replenishment. Long-term effects of this proposal may increase the rate of evictions due to unsafe living conditions or the inability to independently manage finances. Homelessness may send individuals to already overcrowded shelters where they run the increased risk of being abused or exploited. We may see recidivism in both juvenile and adult detention centers because, as history has shown us, this is what counties resort to for crisis intervention when there's no resources remaining. The proposal that DSPs be charged $50 to register and annually renew with the lead agency is not only bad timing with our economy, but it also adds an additional barrier to those who want to become a direct support professional. This means less applicants for consumers and agencies to hire from. When you barely live paycheck to paycheck, $50 means sacrificing basic necessities. In Minnesota, direct support professionals earn an average of $10.54 an hour, with little to no benefits, no set schedules, or a guaranteed number of hours. The last legislative session imposed a monthly cap of 310 hours, which was then unfairly pushed back to 275 hours. In addition, DHS denied payment for hours worked more than 16 hours per day. These hourly caps that have been imposed are being done so in the sake of savings. I don't see it for the safety for the consumer or concern for the health and well-being of the direct support professional. You can examine other occupations and see that people of all ages are working 2 to 3 jobs right now to make ends meet. I ask you why individuals who provide these supports and services to the disability community are being marginalized and singled out. In closing, I want to share with you that one of the greatest obstacles the disability community faces is that we have very little visible strength in numbers. Despite the number of MA recipients and the over 45,000 enrolled DSPs, MCIL has a hotline in which we receive calls from consumers and DSPs telling us that they can't take time off work, don't have accessible or affordable transportation to get here, and they're afraid to speak. I have heard from many consumers that asking for help is one of the hardest things that they can do. We aren't asking anymore. We're practically begging and pleading that you make policy and budget decisions that are more responsible. The disability community has been targeted for more than their share of cuts already. Please remember that independence costs less and that the consequences which I've projected before you are greater than any deficit we're facing now or have had to face. Thank you for listening to me.
Thank you very much for coming. Questions, members? Okay, thank you very much. The members have questions that for like technical questions or roughly technical questions that for the department? Diane?
Well, Mr. Chair and
Representative Loeffler, sir.
That's okay. We were all tired enough to let pro forma go away. On some of these registration things that we have here, when they were lower amounts, I can understand where it wasn't related to the size of the facility, but I'm wondering if we've ever looked at or thought about that. For example, the housing with services establishment going up to $2,000. Well, if you're an 80-unit facility that's charging people $3,000 a month or more, that may not seem like something you can't absorb, but Representative Clark's committee really has charged more of the housing area, and for housing, supportive housing programs, for a variety of housing programs that are smaller scale that we have really made as part of the solution to a variety of programs, if you're only serving a small number of people, this could be a dramatic increase. And so I would hope that if we have the state agency looking at these issues and costing out options, that they would look at what we could do in terms of scaling this so it's actually affordable to all of the impacted entities.
Okay. Any other questions? And you don't have to come out if you can just listen and take notes and get back to us on that. Okay. Seeing no other representative.
Just to the whole general idea of this, and I just remember when Representative Finstad took on some county mandate relief a number of years ago, and he's since retired, but it was actually they were nicer to you in this thing. It was, but we are in some very challenging times, and I don't like this bill at all. But I think it's productive to see what may occur in other ways, and maybe there's some ideas that we can get fiscal note of this, can get out of the committee and move along. But you know, I remember I've had too many of these dialogues since I've been here. And the dialogue pretty much goes, my thing is essential, just please turn the knife to somebody else. And that's, and Representative Hosh bravely pointed the knife at some people that he likes pretty well. And so that's, and thanks for the 200 emails. I couldn't find my other mail at all. So, but anyway, and if it gets some people interested to weigh into the dialogue, then there's some productive part of that. But even beyond that, we have the worst challenge facing us that we ever have. There's no huge pot of money to come rescue us from stimulus money next time, maybe a little stimulant or something, but not the massive part coming in to salvage some of these things. And we have to make some real decisions. And that makes this job not very pleasant. And if this can be the start of a collaborative dialogue, that'll be productive. If it's only the start of groups waging, getting their forces marshaled to protect their particular niche from some retrenchment when other people with greater needs are going to go lacking, then that's instructive as well. Just that's why I'm saying this part of it, just to encourage people. In 2003, I've said this a number of times here, but I'm just going to remind the audience, which is full of people who have tremendous hearts and passion and challenges and represent people who have great needs. But I coined the term essential, important, and nice. And it's not so hard to balance a billion, which is we're getting used to that. But to balance 5.8 or who knows what the next number is going to be is going to be very, very difficult. Even in the face of even some people propose new revenue. If you raise $2 billion, you're still short 5 or 3 next time. And 3 on that is massive. And can people afford the 2, which is a question. So I just wanted to offer those thoughts. And I think that I just wanted to commend, I'm not going to vote for the bill, but I want to just commend the representative for his integrity in bringing this forward and bringing these ideas that are painful to talk about.
Representative Hosh.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, thank you. I think this was a good discussion, and that's why I'm here, is to have a discussion and to understand what the potential impacts are going to be, not only to institutions, but people. I can tell you firsthand, the PCA cuts that have already happened and the ones that are in line are painful, and I work with them every day that have had their hours reduced or are on the chopping block into the future. For our long-term care institutions that in many places are the economic engine of small communities, are on the verge of collapse. And we need to talk about what the decisions are ahead of us. We need to understand them. And we need to be able to look at things differently than just simple across-the-board approaches that doesn't fundamentally address some of the challenges we have in front of us. The decision now isn't to support or oppose this bill, it's to simply move it on so we can continue this discussion. I hope we don't have to do any of this. I hope that we can minimize the worst decisions and make the bad ones so we can rebuild ourselves when prosperity comes back. But this is a tough bill to carry. It's tough to look folks in the eye and maybe not understand what's going to happen now, but being scared about what's into the future. And I hope that we can move forward and try to figure things out collaboratively with each other. We may not always agree, but it's time to start looking at all these ideas and seeing how it impacts people and institutions and picking the best of the poor options in front of us.
Okay, I'll renew my motion that House File 3442 as amended, be referred to the Committee on Finance without recommendation. All in favor of that motion say aye.
Aye.
All opposed?
No.
Motion prevails. We're adjourned.